Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and myself today is the newly promoted Lee Boyce. Now, assistant editor slash personal finance editor slash Lee, I'm not going to say this every time, so just a quick one. Can you pick one?
Yeah, I'll think about it.
All right, fair enough. Well, coming up, while Lee thinks about that, welcome to 1984, the hidden twist in the smart meter saga that could see suppliers take control of your account. Victory for the fans as Ticketmaster takes a significant step to combat professional touts. Also, can you get on the property ladder with 10 grand? And how to avoid being a CV cliche. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk. or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
But first, the backlash is building against smart meters, which, it turns out, well, may not be so smart at all, nor so money-saving. The government's £11 billion scheme to install 53 million smart meters in homes and small businesses by the end of 2020 has been dogged by problems. But now it appears there may be more hidden nasties. A wireless tech expert says they have the power to take over customer accounts so suppliers could cut off a household's electricity or gas without visiting the property, add debt to a meter, remove credit on an account, change the charge levied, or turn the meter into a prepayment device. Authority to use these functions has yet to be granted, but it all sounds a little bit brotherish. So Lee, I know you're a big fan of smart meters. So just remind us, what are they and why is the government just so wedded to them? Because am I right in feeling it does feel like some momentum's building against them at the moment?
Yeah, I would say that that's correct, Georgie. I think the people who have wanted a smart meter have probably gone ahead and got one. And that means now trying to convince the rest of the country that haven't got one to get one. But basically, smart meters were announced in 2009. By 2020, we're all meant to have one in our houses. That's not going to happen now. There's now calls for it to be delayed till 2023. Basically, they measure your energy usage. So you can see in pounds and pence how much you're spending on a minute-by-minute, hourly, daily, or weekly or monthly basis.
So which in theory sounds kind of cool, right?
It sounds kind of cool in theory, but I feel like I've been led down the garden path a little bit with these, Georgie, because okay, at the end of the day, we were told that these were going to save us more money than now we're being told it's going to save us, which, you know, is not what people were signing up for. We've got old technology smart meters being put into people's homes still, in which there's a new generation of smart meters sort of in the wings, ready to sort of be installed into people's homes that a lot of people were holding out for. And now it seems that they're plagued with problems. It's been a classic government rollout of something that it's gone ahead and pushed on with, and it's pushing and pushing and pushing on with now because it's very hard to sort of have a U-turn on this. But I can't see how they are going to get one in every single person's home, because they're not compulsory, and if people don't want one, they don't have to have one.
Also, isn't the reality only about 11 million? I say only, but you know, only 11 million when you think that they want to install 53 million in
a year and a half now.
Yeah.
Not even a year and a half. I know, but this is it. So, it's absolutely, you know, your energy provider will try and push you on to getting a smart meter. And that's because they're under pressure from, you know, in the background to get these into people's homes. I'll give a story. I'm with First Utility. One of my outdoor meters has gone. It's just not working. You can't replace the battery or do anything with it. So I phoned up and said, you know, this is not working. Would you like a smart meter? No, I just want you to come and fix my outdoor meter. Well, you could get a smart meter. Yeah, I could, but I don't want, and it's that and that and that. And I think I might have even mentioned this in the podcast a few months ago, in which I got a letter with a bribe so I could get £60 worth of Amazon vouchers if I took a smart meter. You know, this is what's happening, because people are slowing down getting these devices in their homes, and a lot of people are getting more clued up about them. So at the moment, you've got this Smets One, which is basically the first generation of smart meters. They're pretty dumb. You can't switch them over to other providers, which in a world we're encouraged to switch energy provider, you know, every year to get the best deal.
And you can save hundreds compared to 11 quid or whatever they're saying.
Exactly. But you can't switch them across. So the next generation is meant to be able to do that. They were meant to be sort of being rolled out kind of in a couple of months' time, but that's been delayed now until early next year. And do you know what really gets my goat with smart meters, Georgie? It is the advertising budget that they've had to push these on people. The amount of celebrities.
Maxine Peake, haven't they, at the moment?
They've had numerous people. Phil and Kirsty, you know, of Location, Location, Location. They've been doing a big old drive on them. Yeah, but they're quite a big Channel 4 stars, you know, in the property game. That's exactly the sort of person that they want. Ainsley Harriott. I remember Ainsley Harriott did a 4-minute advert. It went last
four
year.
4 minutes?
Now, I'm gonna admit to something here. I watched the Great British Bake Off last year, and in between they had the whole section of advert, so it was just one big advert.
How much
and it
that
was
would have cost?
It must have been an absolute fortune. And guess who's paying for it? You know, fundamentally, and where it all comes around, it comes down to us, doesn't it? And the thing is, it's just frustrating because it's one of those things you can imagine, you know, all these sort of like ministers sitting around, oh yeah, this sounds like a great idea, let's get this pushed out. And that's kind of what's happened, and I just don't think it's been an absolute failure.
So Lee's a big fan, Simon. Any saving graces? I do want to ask you as well, because Lee just touched on there, how much this is adding to our bills? Because if you take into account all of the government's sort of green energy policies that are added to our bills, it is a significant whack, isn't it?
Yes. I suppose in defence of smart meters, one thing you could say is that due to the fact that they are so much more sophisticated than your old-fashioned meter, you would be able to see exactly how much extra power was used when the entire nation stood up and switched the kettle on rather than watch 4 minutes of Ainsley Harriott talking about smart meters.
Touché.
Look, it's adding money to our bills. I think the quoted figure is something like about £30 a year. I think that's correct. I have a smart meter. And I like my smart meter. My energy company, which is OVO, contacted me probably well over a year ago and said, we'd like to give you a smart meter. Would you be willing to have someone come around and do it? I said, yeah, all right. Not quite as flexible as I would have liked them to be in terms of the appointment, as in it was one of those we'll come round either in this half of the day or that half of the day kind of jobs. But they did call ahead and tell us when they would be coming round. But that's not that useful. I mean, to be honest, I think this is one of the major problems. If these energy companies want to be fitting smart meters, which, to be fair, they're being told they have to fit smart meters, and some of them are being fined for not fitting enough smart meters, which is ironic considering their customers are saying, we don't want the smart meter. They need to be specific about when they can come round. I work 45 minutes from my house. My wife works for herself. She can't just suddenly duck out in the middle of the day. I can't duck out in the middle of the day. Most people don't work in jobs where they can just duck out in the middle of the day. Now, fortunately, my wife is going to be in that day anyway, or she arranged that she could be in. Guy comes around, fits the smart meter. Next thing that happened is we have the smart meter outside, little flashing lights. That's telling my energy company how much energy I'm using. Good thing. Inside, we have the bit that's meant to help you save energy. And the bit that's meant to help you save energy is a little reader, and it tells you how much energy you're using at any given time. Now, the idea is that we'd all get into this sort of gamified energy use. And what we'd be doing is trying to make sure we were using as little energy as possible and trying to go around switching off the lights, you know, watching TV in the dark, only using the kettle when Ainsley Harriott's on. But of course, one of the first things that I did was, because it was on my kitchen counter and space is a premium on my kitchen counter and so are plug sockets, was I unplugged it and put it in a cupboard. And it has remained there ever since.
I remember this. Yeah, I'm not surprised you said you like it. I thought it was
So my smart meter in that sense is dumb. But I love the bit outside telling OVO exactly how much energy I'm using. I love the bit where my energy bills are right every month.
Yeah.
I love the bit where I don't suddenly swing wildly from credit to debit as I used to with Empower, who, despite billing me on a monthly basis, just couldn't seem to get it right. I absolutely think that they are really good in that sense, but there is a fundamental problem with the system that's going on, one of which is that people don't want the damn things, two of which is that the ones that are being forced on them aren't particularly good anyway. As Lee said, there are two separate systems here, and I had this explained to me very well by someone, a lady called Jane Lucy, who works for a company called Labrador, which is a switching company. And their whole thing is that they actually take a feed of the data from your smart meter. They see how much energy you're using, and then they tell you the best tariffs to switch to. And you sign up to it, and they'll just keep switching you. Whenever it's worth you switching, they'll switch you. They'll send you a notification saying, we think it's worth you switching to so-and-so, push the button kind of thing. And you do it. It's meant to take the fuss out of it. But she also knows a lot about the smart meters, obviously. And as Lee said, you've got this SMETS 1 system, which is the original rollout of smart meters, and they're not very good. They can't, all the different suppliers not all of them. You've got chunks of suppliers running off different systems. So depending on who you switch to, they might not be able to use your smart meter. So your smart meter might have to revert to a dumb meter. Or you've got this SMETS 2 system, which is meant to be the all-saving one.
Mm.
But they've only rolled out 9,000 of those so far. And some of them don't work.
Oh, my
word. So it's not even 9,000 working ones. It's
not even 9,000 and rising.
And Jane explained that she thinks the problem is the technology behind the SMETS 2 is just not robust enough yet. The problem is the tech behind it. And we're basically running ahead of ourselves. But we're running ahead of ourselves and we've got an entire sort of cottage industry of trying to bully people into taking smart meters that aren't good enough yet. Let alone worrying about all of these other things that we're talking about that mean they need to be very carefully policed. We're not even carefully policing the rollout of the meters themselves.
So we're all big fans here, but I just head in hand every time I think of government and technology and anything like that, because by the time this actually does come out, whether that's 2020, 2023, mm-hmm. technology's going to have moved so much faster than what's being offered that actually... will these really be relevant anymore? Okay, so we've got a few issues with them. Do they save us that much money? There are some households, they just simply don't work at all. Can you get a time when they can fit it that is convenient to you? And now we hear, Lee, there is something else. I didn't realise that we'd go on quite so long about how much you didn't like them. But the point of this story is there's a whole nother element which Simon just touched on there. You know, we knew about privacy. I mean, mm-hmm. companies can know, suppliers can know when you most use your energy, mm-hmm. and therefore, in theory, they could raise them. Mm-hmm. There's got to be something in this for suppliers. Mm-hmm. Is this it? Is this what this wireless tech expert is saying, that they have the power to take control of our accounts and charge us willy-nilly?
Well, just to rewind a little bit on that, I think some of the concerns of our readers have been exactly what you just touched on there, Georgie. So they're able to see, the suppliers are able to see exactly when you are peak energy using, which they already have an indication of that anyway, because that's why you can get overnight tariffs in which, you know, the prices drop. But this would be even more sort of in-depth, and they'd be able to see exactly, you know, the habits of millions of people, and for that reason they could, you know, change to charge energy for how they see fit. Now we know that they've already got it. The other thing that people are a little bit concerned about is the safety element of, if you went away for a couple of weeks, it's pretty obvious that you're not in the house because your electricity and gas usage has gone right down, and that's just a clear indication that you're away. And a couple of things that people just really do not like. And why would you have that?
Yes,
if you're feeling like you don't want that. Now, this latest little nugget is definitely going to be something, again, that I don't think our readership is going to be particularly happy about. So they have the ability, these smart meters, to eventually grant powers to the suppliers. They don't have these powers yet. They've not been given an authority to use these powers.
But it's the coding, right?
But it's the coding. And what it could do, it could enable suppliers to raid credit balances built up by consumers, turn off suppliers remotely, raise prices, and even switch problem customers onto a prepayment scheme, just like that. And that is the kind of big brother fear that a lot of people have about these smart meters. And because suppliers don't have that at the moment, that's kind of fine. But who knows what legislation may change in the near future to grant suppliers more action to that. And now Grant Shapps, remember Grant Shapps?
Yeah, of course.
You know, he's heading up this campaign of like 93 MPs saying that this has been a complete and utter, you know, nightmare. You know, spent absolutely billions of pounds on this obsolete technology and it's been ridiculous. And their stats are saying the savings made are actually, these are annual savings, by the way.
Mm.
So the official figure is £26, but they're saying it's actually more like £11 a year. So we're talking not even a pound a month.
When you think 30 quid a year is being added to roll these out,
exactly.
Year, right?
So you can now see the my problem
is
with smart meters.
Is anyone a fan of these?
Well, there are people. You know, we do write these stories, and we do have some people sticking up for smart meters.
Right.
Actually, say, you know, I find it quite useful, and I guess it could be quite useful if you're a big family, and you could kind of, you know, as Simon said, gamify the whole. Yeah, you know, but is that exciting enough? Do kids really want to go? You know, kids just want to play on their computers or have lights on, or, you know, you're not going to be. Well, look, if you turn this off,
meter.
You could see this little, like, you know, bar go down a little bit. I just can't see, for me, people know not to waste, on the whole, no, not to waste electricity. They don't want to be paying for higher bills. This have been things that have been going on for decades, Georgia. I mean, I remember when I was growing up, my dad would be like, don't leave that light on. And that's just a dad thing and a mum thing, isn't it? It's a parent thing. Don't leave that on. Unplug that. That's just the original smart meter. It was our parents, Georgie, back in the day, telling you not to leave things switched on and plugged in. I just think this is really, honestly, there's not many things I'm this passionately against, but I actually think smart meters are really quite awful.
I was grinning at the idea of your parents as the original smart meter. Turn that light off. I think that the big issue for people is also probably not their electricity use either. A lot of their bills comes from their gas use. It's heating their home. So obviously if you've got electric heating, but most people in the country have gas heating. So it doesn't really do anything to solve that issue of their bills. So we're only actually talking about less than half of people's energy bills. And the real problem that people have with their energy bills over recent years has been the gas price. Now, obviously this might change because if we all start driving electric cars, as we're meant to, then we're going to start using a lot more electricity. And one of the concerns surrounds surge pricing and the ability to personalise pricing. You can get too smart. And I think one of the industries where we have seen things get too smart and where you can take a read across from is the insurance industry, whereby, imagine your car's parked by the side of the road. Someone drives down the road, hits your car, they don't do the decent thing and leave a note. Off they go, they trundle off. If you have to make a claim on your insurance, next time you go to renew your insurance will go up. Even if you don't make a claim on your insurance and you pay for it yourself, you still have to declare that. And next time you renew your insurance, your cover will go up. Now, the argument for that is because apparently, even though someone hit your car when you weren't even in it, and it might not have even been parked anywhere near your house. It might have been parked in a place where you've only ever been to once in your life and you probably won't ever go to ever again. They will put your premium up next year because you are now statistically more likely to be involved in a crash. The problem is that insurance really works because it's a pooled risk. So you don't end up charging one unfortunate group too much. Young drivers, for example. We need to be pooling that risk much better. And once you start drilling down into individuals, then clearly, to the consumer, that is completely unfair, that situation I just described. Now, you can do that again with the energy pricing. If you can see exactly when people are using their electricity, you can get rid of any concept of peak and off-peak like you used to have. And in fact, you can go the other way. So you can start introducing their own personal peak time. So if they normally charge their car at night, your pricing now goes up at night time because you're using more energy. Yes, but we've got to put your pricing up at night time because everybody's using more energy at night time. We've got to help manage the flow to the grid. So we've got to discourage you from doing that, encourage you to doing it during the day. You can work back from any position and justify it if you like. But I think this is probably that's the area where we're going to see the biggest amount of concern. There's also a security issue about whether these Wi-Fi enabled devices are secure enough and whether they could be used for a massive denial of service attack as well. But I'm not technically minded enough to explain that one.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, another matter that's caused rather a lot of controversy recently, secondary ticketing website. Now, the idea, a bit like smart meters, I suppose, good one, you offload your unwanted ticket, you can't go anymore to a gig or an event. However, they've been exploited by touts for years who snap up tickets at face value and then they flog them for massively ramped up prices. Now, after pressure from fans, consumer groups, MPs, the watchdog and celebrities, Ticketmaster is to permanently close its sites, Get Me In and Seatwave. So, Lee, reminders, secondary ticketing websites. Again, something, as I said, that's been causing a lot of controversy recently.
Well, I wouldn't even say it's recently, Georgia. I'd say this has been sort of bubbling away for a good decade or so now. Yeah, because what happens is if you want to go and see a specific gig, let's take music for an example. Mm. So you want to go and see a specific gig, you know, you have to get on that website and you have to queue up and you have to get tickets, and it can be a real rigmarole sometimes, especially if it's for popular tickets. What's happened is that these sort of websites to buy the tickets are being exploited by a tout. So professional touts, they can sit around get as many tickets as possible, you know, use all different devices and snap up loads of these tickets. They could take a massive pool of these tickets out of the South. And genuine fans who might be a couple minutes behind are going to miss out and not get tickets to that gig at face value. What happens is those touts then take those tickets and they relist them onto these secondary websites for a far inflated price. And people end up, if they want to go and see the gig that bad, end up paying absolutely over the odds for it. And we have argued for a long time, this is money. This is just a complete unfair system. And a lot of artists have really cottoned on and getting onto the fan side. Adele, Ed Sheeran.
Yeah,
you know, they've been really. And actually, I quite rate them for it because it's very easy to lose sight of your fans and lose reality with them, I guess. But someone like Ed Sheeran, you know, I imagine he's quite a humble guy. Fundamentally, as a fan of music, if you can't go and see an artist that you want to go and see, it's quite frustrating. And it's quite nice to see that he's sort of realised that problem and trying to do something about it and being outspoken. And so have a number of tour managers and those that organise these other tours. So what's happened now is the Ticketmaster, they had two secondary websites, one that they set up, I think, in about 2008 or 2009, and then another one that they snapped up in 2014. Because there's money to be made in it, because they get a cut of the commission and it tends to be quite a nice, healthy slice. And to be honest, they've kind of buried their head in the sand about the problem.
Well, that's going to be a question. Why has it taken so long for them to do anything about this?
There's been a review from the Competition and Markets Authority, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're thinking ahead and realising that the CMA might now start looking at actually properly cracking down on these, because they've been looking into them for a little while anyway. Some of these firms are just devoid of coming up with any kind of answers, especially if we've got questions to them. Like, you know, we could get palmed off quite a lot from these secondary websites. And actually, I think Ticketmaster have gone ahead and done this because they kind of know what's coming and they can see the future. And actually, there's a lot of companies now that are secondary websites for the fans. You know, I'm thinking Twickets, Vibe are two of the big ones in which they try and offer a fair deal to fans. And I think what's going to happen, what would happen, is that a lot of fans have seen negative press about some of these secondary websites and will actually go on Twickets or Vibe or whatnot and actually go, well, look, these guys are actually genuine fans, because there are reasons that you buy a gig ticket and you can't make it.
Some of them are really far in advance, and you want to sell them,
and you don't mind selling them at face value. You just want to get your money back for them. You're not looking to turn a quick profit, and that's the problem with touts and professional touts that do this. If you had tickets, you just want to sell them fairly somewhere. Ticketmaster's realizing that they get a bad reputation of these companies that they own. It doesn't look good for them in the first place. What they're saying now is, if you buy a ticket and you want to sell it, you can just click a button on their website and you can only sell it for face value or less. So you won't be able to make a profit on the ticket you bought. It just feels like common sense to me, and it'd be good to see this happening across the board. And hopefully, the biggest concern about it is that does it start pushing up prices?
Well, Ticketmaster say they're going to have a 15% surcharge on every ticket, but also this dynamic pricing thing that, Simon, you were talking about with smart meters.
Well, so firstly, I would suggest that one of the reasons why Ticketmaster have decided to offload these two sites might be down to simple economics. And I think they're not making as much money from them anymore. I think the easy money's been made. And I'll explain why. And I'll go back in time. 12th of December, 2007, by Simon Lambert. Why we are fighting the ticket ripoff. We started a campaign against these ticket reselling sites in 2007. Wow. I remember going to a Parliament Select Committee meeting shortly after that. I'm imagining it was early 2008, where they were talking about potentially banning them completely. Now, unfortunately, the market won out. And the argument was, well, if you don't have a ticket that you can't use, why shouldn't you be able to sell it on? Mm-hmm. And a lot of focus just went into trying to make sure that the tickets were genuine. There have been problems where tickets weren't genuine. There have been problems where tickets are listed for sale that aren't actually even out yet. But the real issue here, and we had this explained to us at the time, by Harvey Goldsmith, who's a very famous music promoter. The economics of the music industry are funny, okay? And they're even funnier now, where people can't rely on selling records to make money. They have to get peanuts off the streaming systems and then try and make money back off merch and gigs. But the economics of the music industry are funny. And the funniest place in the music industry for economics is gigs. Now, what bands want to do when they're starting out, or artists want to do when they're starting out, is get as many people as possible through the door and get a little bit of cash. So, they'll price the tickets low then to try and get people in the door. But once they're successful, they can kind of name their price. And you see this with a lot of the big artists doing the big kind of mega tours and stuff like this. But they deliberately price their tickets, popular bands deliberately price their tickets cheaper than they could sell them for. Say the Arctic Monkeys are doing a gig and they sell their tickets for 40 quid. They could probably sell those tickets for 80 quid or 90 quid and they'd make more money. You know, there's a simple calculation at the background that someone's going to do. Demand and supply. But they don't price them that much because they want their fans to be able to afford to go to the gig. And that's what's part of being a fan. It builds the loyalty over the years. It's the people who get to go to every tour that the band does and things like that. They're the people who buy the records. They're the people who support them year in, year out, not just in the year when they're the biggest hit and then someone's forgot about them. There are people out there playing gigs now who have had, you know, 40, 50 year long music careers. We've got the same people seeing them now as they did 50 years ago. And this bit where they deliberately price the tickets cheaper is fundamentally important to this. And what these websites have done have busted that open, because there's always been ticket touting. But what this meant is it enabled people to ticket tout from their bedroom, these bedroom touts. You basically get on there, you hoover up all the tickets, and actually some of them were buying programs that helped them beat all the things that were trying to stop them, that you could only buy 4 tickets, 6 tickets, sitting there with multiple credit card numbers, and then you relist them at a massively inflated price, and you would see tickets go up on the reselling sites within hours, within an hour, within half an hour of gigs being sold out. All of a sudden, lo and behold, there's loads of people who suddenly realise they couldn't go. It's like, oh yeah, I bought tickets to that gig in 9 months' time. I've just realised I can't go in 9 months' time. Oh, I'll sell them on for 3 times the price. I mean, like, what a load of nonsense that this was just ordinary fans selling on tickets that they couldn't use. I mean, that was just, it was so transparently guff. It was unbelievable. Yeah. And what happened was it then made it worse for people trying to buy tickets, because theoretically, in the internet age, it should have been easier to get tickets as a fan because you just go online and do it. But actually, it became, the floodgates opened. I remember when I was a kid and we went to see Guns N' Roses in 1991 or 92. I think it was 92. We had a conversation. Can we go? Can we go? Can we go? We had to convince one of our parents to ring up with the credit card and book the tickets. Nowadays, it's like, we need to go buy tickets now. Yeah. You can't even get onto the website to buy them. Oasis at Nebworth in 96, same thing. Of course you had people queuing up at the box office. Of course you had people trying to phone up exactly the same time. But you didn't have to be right in there. Now you've got to be in there in the first, literally, you've got to be
seconds,
waiting,
even then,
ready to go, press the button and in there. And even then you can't get in. Yeah, because the bots are locking people out. You've got all these ticket touts hoovering up. And it means people can't get the tickets when they go on sale. So then they're feeling that they have to buy them at the inflated prices because they really want to go see their favourite band. And the problem is, to go back to what I said at the start, is this is filtered back through because the artists and the promoters are the people taking the risk that people won't turn up. They book the venues, all that money, putting on a gig costs loads of money. And what if not enough people turn up? And then they're deliberately pricing the tickets a bit lower so that they're not profiteering from it. But then they've got someone who comes along and is making a load of money off the back of it. They're not really taking any of the risk. They're just trading tickets. So what's happened is you've started to see a huge amount of ticket price inflation, particularly for the big gigs, for the superstars, who have gone, well, hang on a minute, and particularly their promoters, have gone, well, hang on a minute. We're putting these tickets on sale for 40 quid and then loads of people are buying them for 100 quid. We might as well price them at 60. We might as well price them at 80. Now, this is to go back to where I said I think that there's a problem with the economics of it, is, of course, once you start to get the tickets becoming more and more expensive at face value. So I went to see the Stones this year. Basically, once you included the booking fee, 100 quid a ticket. Once you start to get it to be 100 quid a ticket, including that booking fee, for a tout to then buy it and then flog it on at a profit becomes that much harder. Because, yes, we've all heard these stories of £400 tickets to see so-and-so, £250 tickets to see so-and-so. But really, where most of the volume of these tickets is tickets bought for 60 quid, tickets sold for 80 quid or 100 quid. It's the lower margin ones. But if the tickets start at 100, it's very difficult for them to make the money, especially after they've paid all the fees. So I think there's been a huge drop-off in this going on. And funnily enough, those Stones gigs, actually, they did a load of gigs around the UK and they didn't sell all the tickets. You could have bought tickets on the day to some of those gigs. And they even, in order to reward the fans and do something, they did a lucky dip thing where basically you signed up, you bought a ticket, you turned up at the box office on the day, and you got given your tickets, and they could have been anywhere in the stadium. They could have been right up in the gods. They could have been in the standing bit where anyone else was. I know someone who turned up on the day, lucky dip tickets, got them in the golden circle down the front, and they paid something like 25, 30 quid, and they got like 500 quid tickets.
And that's great, because they can't sell it on if they're there at the ground to pick up the tickets.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is about this bedroom touting thing and these reselling sites, which you will know by the fact that I'm talking about an article we wrote in 2007 and what I've just said, that I'm not a big fan of them. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you who else isn't a big fan of them. I've actually got a friend, an old friend of mine, who is actually a ticket tout.
Oh.
An old-fashioned ticket tout. I mean, obviously, they do things in different ways nowadays. They use Facebook and things like that. But he doesn't do this. He hates these sites. And all of your old-fashioned ticket touts, you used to see... Yeah, but that is effectively their job outside of the system. But that is their job. If you talk to them, they don't want you to get fake tickets. They don't want any of these things. They want to buy a ticket off someone else someone doesn't want to use. They want to sell it onto you for a profit, and they want you to get into that gig or that game or whatever you're meant to be going to, because actually, funnily enough, these people do take a pride in their work, believe it or not. If they're doing it week in, week out, they're not just petty criminals who want to rip people off. And the ticket touts absolutely hate these sites. And if you're even hated by the proper ticket touts, well, my, your reputation ain't great.
I was going to say, I'd given up. I wouldn't bother going. I wouldn't bother going to any of the big gigs or anything like that, Lee. I just can't be bothered. But I have to say, I'm quite lucky in the fact I've got quite modest taste. You don't get any of this when you get tickets to things like Derby or AFC Wimbledon or James Taylor, as I've done recently. Mm. Derby do have dynamic ticketing pricing, though, which is a bit annoying. But one thing I will say before we move on, while this is great from Ticketmaster and we're getting rid of Get Me In and Seatwave, there are a couple more still out there.
Mm.
So this is still going to go on unless something happens to this.
Well, let's wait and see what the CMA come out with, because I reckon there's got to be something bubbling away there that's going to sort of crack down on this. I mean, Viagogo have already been singled out previously anyway, and I don't know if they've quite hit the mark of what they've been asked to have done, but I know that they're very much in the sights of the CMA. I think they're based in Switzerland. Mm. They're very hard to get hold of. I found in the past, if there's ever been a reader issue, all you can do, and I always say this, is just vote with your feet and just don't go on those websites. If you're really desperate for those tickets, I still wouldn't go for them. That's me personally. I've seen the tactics that have been used. Some of the tickets on the Viagogo could be very expensive.
Oh, outrageous. Right? You
know, absolutely outrageous. And I don't know. I just think, is it really worth paying completely over the odds for tickets? I don't know. It's very easy to say because it might be an artist that you want to tick off your bucket list that you've maybe never seen. But I still just don't think it's the way to do it.
Some people say, look, it's the market at work, though. If people want to pay
supply
for that,
and demand,
then,
George,
yeah,
it
absolutely.
It's a supply and demand.
Why should we get involved?
Exactly. If they've been listed for that price, it must be for a reason. People must be buying them. So, hey, look, I mean, it's just it's one of those industries.
And what you said, one final thing on that, is there is a comment on our story from a guy calling himself, I presume a guy calling himself Miles Giles One. I
mean, right, yeah.
Two men's names.
I can see why you think that. Yeah.
He said, what I'd really like to know is what is the difference between a concert ticket and anything else you can buy? You don't have a divine right to see Adele for 50 quid. I don't have a divine right to dine at Ramsay's for the same price. It's a market economy, and if Adele or Sheeran cared at all, they wouldn't have dealt with Ticketmaster at all. They would have more than enough money to set up their own ticket agency and sell in whatever way they deem fairest. For example, just to fans registered on their fan sites. Except, of course, that would have cost them a few quid. The biggest advantage of resale sites is you can book right up to the day of the event, not months or years in advance. Well worth paying a little extra for. This is a move in the wrong direction. Ticketmaster will now have variable pricing as they do in America. Just watch for the stink that creates and don't say I didn't warn you. So I would say the variable pricing thing is, yeah, we really need to watch out for that because we could get all this replaced with something much worse. But as I said, the economy of gigs and gig tickets is it doesn't work like that. It's not a free market economy. Mm-hmm. And actually, a lot of these big artists do sign up to their, if you want to go see them, sign up to their mailing list, sign up to their fan sites, because they tell their fans first, and a lot of them give their fans special codes to get tickets first. And also the other thing is watch out for things like Barclaycard, American Express, stuff like that, because that's a way to get in ahead of the queue. And if you can get into the pre-sale, then you normally can get tickets and you don't have the madness when they first go up.
All right, thank you very much for that. Right, let's move on. The good news is first-time buyer numbers are at their highest level for a decade. The bad news is that deposits needed are still pretty huge, especially in London, and especially if you don't have access to the bank of mum and dad. But can you really do it on 10 grand? Well, that's a query from one of your readers, Annie, in her 20s. She got a £10,000 windfall and wants to invest to help buy property in 3 years' time. So can she do it? What should she do? Lee, tell us a little bit more about Annie.
Well, first of all, I'm going to big up our series here. This is a Money Pit Stop series in which we get readers contact us and we try and answer with some experts and give them some sound advice. We'd encourage any listeners to get involved. Just email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk and we'll forward you back a form you can fill in and we'll get onto it. So this case is someone, she's 27 years old. She's a regular reader of This Is Money, which is good to hear. And she recently received £10,000. What she wants to do, buy a property in 3 years' time. Very difficult. She's based in London. That is the difficulty when a typical house price is probably going to be sort of property price is going to be £450 plus. So if you're working on a 10% basis, you're talking sort of, you know, £40,000 to £50,000.
She's way off.
Quite a lot, but there are pockets, you know, in outer London and perhaps, you know, some of the other counties that sort of surround it, in which in 3 years' time you might possibly be able to do this.
So, of which that 10 grand will just go on your train fare, though.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Unless you get a workplace loan, you can get it sucked out of your wages. Yeah, don't get me started. So anyway, 3 years' time to turn that £10,000 into a house deposit. Now, you know, you don't know what's going to happen between now and 3 years' time, and she may get another lump sum form of a bonus.
Does she have anything else?
She's got £1,000. She's got a few little pots here and there. So, you know, you're going to want to sort of merge those together and get that to snowball and, you know, grow in value. Now, the trouble is, if you've got that kind of sum of money and you want to get involved in investing, I mean, as Simon will always say, investing is a long-term game. Mm. And 3 years isn't quite long-term enough in the eyes of the investment world, I would suggest. Because, you know, values of these things go up and down. And if you are after it for a specific purpose, i.e. buying, put it towards a house deposit, it might not necessarily be wise to put all of your eggs in one basket in that form. What we've suggested here, so she's got £1,000 to help to buy ISA, which are kind of now redundant and getting converted into lifetime ISA. So to have a lifetime ISA, that £10,000 will turn into 12.5 grand because of the government bonus. So that's worth doing. That's risk-free. And of course, you can use the lifetime ISA to put towards your first property. So that is pretty ideal. Now, there have been sounds.
You can see my face moving. Lee, I
was one step ahead of you. It was like a chess match, Georgie. I saw you. I saw your move. There was a Treasury committee a couple of weeks ago in which there was a few murmurings about lifetime ISAs actually being a bit ridiculous. And the thing is, we've been kind of saying this for a long time, because you can either put your lifetime ISA towards a pension when you're older, or you can put it towards a first-time property. Two very, very separate things. And it's really sort of muddied the water and makes it confusing for people as to what they should be saving towards in their own private pension, lifetime ISA. And it all gets a little bit complicated. But nonetheless, it is still worth having. I still think it's worth having if you are specifically putting it towards a home, and it has to be a first home, because that bonus is actually really good. I mean, 25% bonus is pretty juicy. You're not going to get a return on that like that over the course of a year. So that is our main advice on this one. Now, we did have an expert answer this as well. So what we do is we tend to give a bit of advice, and then we tend to get some experts to sort of get involved as well. She says she likes the idea of investing into a tracker fund because they're low costs. But there's a couple of things you have to consider if you do that. What they do, they just track certain indexes. So let's say a tracker that goes for the FTSE 100. Again, it can go up and down. FTSE's kind of looking pretty good at the moment, especially with the dollar strengthening against the pound and all that sort of stuff. But again, it's one of those things that we kind of do suggest for a longer term objective. Simon might agree with this, he might disagree with this, but I think you would say a minimum of probably 5 years. 3 years is probably a bit of a short term view on an investment like that.
So, I mean, 3 years is pushing towards 5 years. That's one thing to say, is you're closer to five than you are to zero. However, usually the advice is 5 years. And the reason why it's 5 years is not just because it's a nice round number that's been plucked out of thin air, but that's judged to be a long enough amount of time that you would be substantially reducing the chance of you putting your money in and ending up with less money at the end of that period. Absolutely no guarantee that that isn't going to happen. That there's not like this magic five-year period. If you look at the statistics from the Barclays Equity Gilt Study over any length period of time, and this is a study that goes back about the last 120 years or so, maybe 130 years, you have to go out to about 18 or 19 years to get a zero, to get no period when you would have lost money. But that, you know, that length of period of time would be exceptional. The risk is you invest over the short term, and when you come to get your money, there might be less there than there was when you put it in. Now, you might have made money. You might find up you're up 30%, but you might find you're down 30%. So you need to ascertain how much of a problem that will be for you personally. I.e., if I suddenly discover that my 10 grand is 7 grand, is that going to completely scupper the chances of me buying a house? Or am I going to be able to find that 3 grand to make up the shortfall from somewhere else, perhaps with the promise of repaying it to someone, maybe a loan from friends or family, from family or something like that. And if you think you can get round it, then maybe you can afford to take the risk. Mm. But if you think, no, that's actually going to stop me doing what I want to do, or emotionally I'm going to really struggle with that, or worse still, emotionally, if it suddenly ends up down 30%, I'm going to panic and take all my money out, and then it goes back up, and I would have ended up even, or actually even up, then don't invest the money over the short term. And then also the Help to Buy thing, or the Lifetime ISA, you can put £4,000 a year into one. You're going to get a 25% uplift on that. There ain't many other places you can get an instant 25% uplift on your money. So if I was in this position and I knew I wanted to be buying my first home, and it was definitely my first home, and I wasn't going to get caught out by any clauses that says it's not my first home, I'd be shoveling that money into a Lifetime ISA. And then you can choose to invest in through that, or you can choose cash. And that goes back to the risk thing.
Thank you very much, Simon. Now, one way to get onto the property ladder a little bit faster is to get a better paid job. So how can you stand out from the crowd, Lee, and not be a CV cliche? Yes, you motivated, driven leaders out there. Lee, as the newly promoted blah, 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 have you decided what you want to be called yet? Top cliches you should avoid.
Yeah, so this is some interesting research, actually, that Adzuna crunched for us. And it was basically, they analysed 1.1 million CVs, which is a sizable,
a lot of CVs.
That's a sizable task in itself. And actually, you know, lots of people are fighting after certain jobs. So, you know, especially if you're, you know, a graduate that's just got out of university, or perhaps a school leaver, college leaver, and you want to do something that kind of stands you out of the crowd, basically, because a lot of employers will look at CVs, and a lot of them could be kind of identikit and a little bit difficult to differentiate. So this is just a kind of bit of research that sort of shows the most used sort of words that people use to describe themselves. And number one, as you rightly say there, is motivated. So I'm a motivated individual. And we played this game actually in the office, in which we're trying to get everyone to guess what the top 10 was, sort of, you know, family fortune style. And we got a few, but a few of them got missed off. But a couple of the ones that they say in here that aren't used as much, and they're not too sure why, because they would probably be quite good at things like assertive. There's a couple of good ones here. 19,000 CVs contain the term good sense of humour. Which I always think is a great trait for a job. And then 23,000 had fun. So fun. I'm fun. I love that. Well, it depends. But it depends what you're applying for, doesn't it? I mean, that's the thing. So motivated is in there. Initiative is number two. Social, organised, friendly, leader, experienced, hardworking, outgoing and driven. They're the top 10 sort of words that get used the most in a CV. Now, what I would say is
that some of those are quite good words,
they
right?
are, but your friend is the old dinosaur, the Theosaurus Rex.
Right,
so invest in a decent thesaurus, and then you can basically, you know, change some of these words up and try and stand out from the crowd a little bit. It's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek bit of research here, Georgie. If you want to put any of these terms on your CV, please, by all means, do.
Yeah.
It was just looking.
You are motivated
and I thought
driven.
It was quite interesting to think that, you know, more than a quarter of CVs in that opening statement about yourself says that you're motivated. Now, if you're having one in four candidates telling you that they're motivated, it's kind of like, Yeah, do you know what I mean? I sometimes think if you're going to put something like that on a CV, it's almost like my old English teacher used to say, point, quote, explain. So if you're telling me that you're motivated, you know, give an example of how you're motivated or what makes you motivated. I think at the moment, you know, as I said, there's a lot of people fighting after the same sort of pool of jobs. And it's quite important to think about these things. It doesn't mean don't put that on your CV, but kind of if you're going to put that on your CV, make sure it's justified, because the likelihood is someone else has also put that on their CV.
Simon, as a person who probably trawls through more CVs than most.
I think that's a really good piece of advice that Lee just gave there. A lot of the time, the problem why we're the reason why we're laughing at this research in a way is because they're just empty words, aren't they? They're just words that people feel that they have to put down. And it's really easy to see through the empty words. I mean, it's a long time since I've compiled a CV, to be honest, but I don't have, when I did, I didn't have that little bit at the top, you know, the little blurb about yourself. I'm not against them. I just think that a lot of people just skip over them. I think a lot of the time they contain some empty words, unless you back it up with some specific things. Better to put in there three really interesting things about yourself and why you're the right person to hire and you're a good person to work with than to fill it with, you know, seven sentences using an empty word in each of them. And also, I think the covering letter is probably the most important bit. That's the bit where you say why you want the job, why you think you'd be good for it, what you think you could bring to it, and maybe a little bit about what kind of person you are. And I think that that's the thing I look out for when I get letters of application is has this person told me why they want to come work at This Is Money and why they think they'd be good for it.
Because they're motivated to. They're driven.
Yeah, exactly. This is the important bit. Yeah.
Friendly and fun, Simon.
Yeah. We've got lots of advice on our interview cheat sheet series. And if I could give people one tip of a word not to put in their CV or their covering letter, banter.
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 Oh. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us. People really use banter.
Oh, that's brilliant.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.